This is a podcast from the BBC. For more information and terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/podcasts.
This is the story of a man who was world famous by the time he was 25, yet who, by most accounts, made little money from his success. He was a man of mixed race, who was admired by the highest in Victorian society, whose wealth owed so much to slavery. He was prodigiously talented. Elgar said he was far away the cleverest of the young men. And indeed, he would never grow old. He died suddenly at just 37, leaving a legacy of music of great beauty and ambition, though perhaps he never quite fulfilled his promise. A moving love story, against all the odds, runs through the all-too-short life of this man, who got stolid Brits in their legions dressing up in feathered headdresses as Native Americans. Work which made Samuel Coleridge Taylor's name. The Song of Hiawatha, telling us how the gentle Chibiabos, he, the sweetest of musicians, sang his songs of love and longing. The first part of what would eventually be a trilogy of Hiawatha-inspired works was given its first performance in November 1898 at the Royal College of Music, when Coleridge Taylor was only 23. Sir Arthur Sullivan was in the audience and noted in his diary that night, "Much impressed by the lad's genius. He is a composer, not a music maker. The music is fresh and original, the scoring brilliant and full of colour." The young man suddenly found himself a big success, and with the other two parts of the trilogy he composed later, Hiawatha was performed thousands of times in venues ranging from the Proms in the Queen's Hall in London to the smallest amateur music societies up and down the country. From Croydon, where Coleridge Taylor lived almost all his life, Hiawatha went out to conquer the world. He was a shy, retiring man by nature. In the stiflingly hot, overcrowded hall of the Royal College of Music, he listened to the premiere of his new work from behind a screen. He seems to have been alarmed by the volume of the applause at the end of the performance as the audience went wild and slid into a doorway out of sight. Sir Charles Stanford, professor of composition at the college, had to come and winkle him out and drag him up onto the platform to take a bow. But that shy student could really write. This week I'll be exploring Coleridge Taylor's early chamber music. You may not be familiar with any of his music, but these small, intimate pieces are quite distinct from the rest of his works. At its best, you may find it reminiscent of Dvorak, with the same broad, simple tunes Dvorak was such a master of, as you'll hear in Coleridge Taylor's Nonet. He composed it in 1894, when he was still only 19 and a student at the Royal College of Music. I said that Coleridge Taylor was of mixed race. His father, Daniel Peter Hughes Taylor, was from Sierra Leone. He came to this country first of all for private schooling at Taunton in Somerset and went on to study medicine at King's College London. Accounts of this period have been a bit muddled, but in a publication to mark Coleridge Taylor's centenary, Geoffrey Green points out that within a matter of weeks of qualifying, Taylor returned to Sierra Leone, where he held several posts in the colonial medical service. He almost certainly never saw the child who was born 6 months later to Alice Martin in August 1875 in Holborn in London. Within about 18 months of his birth, little Samuel, his mother and grandparents, moved to Croydon. In all likelihood, his mother and father were never actually married, though Alice seems briefly to have called herself Mrs. Taylor. She later married a George Evans who worked on the railways, and Samuel was joined by several half-brothers and sisters. It was a retired army man in the neighbourhood, Colonel Herbert A. Walters, still only in his 20s at the time, who'd taken charge of the local church choir, who spotted Samuel's exceptional talent and made him his protégé. Tantalisingly, a lot of Coleridge Taylor's music remains unrecorded. So with the help of the BBC singers, we've decided to take this chance to put some more on the map. With its relentless beating rhythm of trochees, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's most famous poem, The Song of Hiawatha, can sound monotonously uninventive and cloyingly sentimental to our 21st century ears. As soon as we hear it, we're likely to think of the infinite parodies of it, like Lewis Carroll's Hiawatha's Photographing. But considered in the context of its time, it's a remarkable work. To give heft to his poetic account of the life of the Native American tribes, Longfellow consciously imitated the rhythm and style of the Finnish national epic, the Kalevala. Longfellow didn't just want to paint pretty pictures of exotic creatures in colourful costumes. Hiawatha was very much a product of its time. It was published in 1855, and it gave the world a portrait of the Red Indian, as Native Americans were then called, as a noble savage in tune with the rhythms of nature. By the time the poem began to be popular in this country, a decade later, people were just becoming aware of what was happening to the American Indian nation. It's only relatively recently that we've come to appreciate the scale of the tragedy that unfolded, of how in the rampant rush for gold and land across the vast American West, the native peoples were seen as a troublesome inconvenience getting in the way of the white man's conquest of the great wilderness. Native people were massacred just as their seemingly limitless herds of buffalo were, and those who didn't then starve to death were decimated by new diseases to which they had no resistance. In telling his powerful, emotional, epic account of a hero's life, loves, and suffering, Longfellow was very reliant on the myth of Hiawatha, a collection of native lore that had been published by the historian, geographer, and ethnologist Henry Rowe Schoolcraft and his wife Jane. She was of mixed parentage, an Ojibwe Indian mother and a Scots-Irish fur trader father. Her Ojibwe name translates as the woman of the sound which the stars make rushing through the sky. I imagine her mixed ancestry was something which would have struck a chord of sympathy with Coleridge Taylor. Schoolcraft became an Indian agent and had responsibility for tribes across the area, which is now northern Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, so he got to know the native peoples and their lore very well. By the time Coleridge Taylor was working on Hiawatha's wedding feast, the remaining Indians had been rounded up and confined to reservations. Samuel Coleridge Taylor was described by many of his contemporaries as coloured. He had an African father and an English mother. We know he suffered from instances of racism in his youth, including one vicious one when his schoolmates set fire to his frizzy hair. But according to his wife Jessie, the colour of Coleridge Taylor's skin doesn't seem to have created a lot of problems for him. Thanks to the patronage of a local Croydon benefactor, Colonel Watson, and the support of Charles Stanford, he got a place at the Royal College of Music in London. He couldn't study composition there because he didn't have the necessary keyboard skills. He was a violinist, but he was there when Sir George Grove and Sir Charles Stanford were on the staff, and Vaughan Williams and Gustav Holst among the students, and he was right up there with the best of them. Coleridge Taylor composed a symphony during his student years in the space of a month. On later visits to the USA, orchestral musicians there started to call him the Black Mahler, but he's certainly not the composer likely to be brought to mind as you listen to the engaging rhythmic complexities of the symphony's first movement. Certainly not Mahler, then, but hints of Dvorak may be in that Symphony in Tea, as Sir Charles Stanford supposed to have christened it after he'd just spilled a cup of Darjeeling over the score of Coleridge Taylor's only symphony. Sadly, when Lewis Foreman examined the score in the Royal College of Music library, he didn't find any tea stains, so that's another good story knocked on the head. On the other hand, Coleridge Taylor was just the sort of man, prepared to tear the score up altogether if Stanford disapproved of it, to have made a fair copy for the library, free of beverage stains. Coleridge Taylor was just 15 when he was admitted to the Royal College of Music in 1890, the same year as Vaughan Williams, who was a rather more typical entrant. Coleridge Taylor would certainly have been exceptional on the grounds of his age and his working-class background, if not the colour of his skin, which, according to his sister, was medium light-coloured. So perhaps that made him less conspicuous than one might have imagined, accounting for the fact that he encountered so little discrimination in late Victorian Britain, when black people and other minorities accounted for a much smaller proportion of the population than they do today. Coleridge Taylor's biographer, Geoffrey Self, writing in the mid-1990s, said that prejudice for reasons of colour had not, in the 1890s, grown to the extent that it's present today. He says that young Samuel, shy as he was, would have been more conscious of himself as an object of immense curiosity. Photographs show that while he plainly had his African father's hair, he seems to have his mother's mouth and perhaps her nose and high forehead. His handsome features are generally rounded, and he seems to have had very fine skin. He's always impeccably dressed, not from expensive, exclusive London brands, but from local shops, and there's a gentleness about his appearance that people who met him always remarked on. Henry Newbolt's famous poem Drake's Drum, as set there by Coleridge Taylor. One of the main sources of information we have about Coleridge Taylor's life is the memoir his wife Jessie published at the instigation of Lord Shaftesbury after his death. She admits that these are sketchy memories, and they're very personal ones, so they don't present a complete account of his life by any means. But Jessie does tell some good stories, such as her account of their courtship. He'd made it clear at the outset that music was his first love, and they would spend afternoons together earnestly revising orchestral or choral parts of his works that were in the hands of the printers. The silence that ensued clearly alarmed the neighbours, who feared that Coleridge Taylor might be up to some hanky-panky, and one day an old maidservant was dispatched to burst in on them, clearly in the hope that he'd be caught in some compromising position. In fact, they were discovered to be at opposite ends of the room. One of the pieces they didn't work on together, since it was never published in his lifetime, was his clarinet quintet. While he was still at the Royal College of Music, Stanford had challenged his composition class that none of them could write a clarinet quintet without being influenced by Brahms's piece for that combination, which he'd written just 4 years earlier. Coleridge Taylor took up the challenge, and in the course of a term produced his own four-movement quintet. 30 years ago, the great American music critic Harold S. Schoenberg, writing for the New York Times, said of it, "This score is anything but a copy of the Dvorak chamber music, or the Brahms clarinet music for that matter. It's an assured piece of writing in the late Romantic tradition, sweetly melodic without being cloying, sometimes with a powerful thrust, and beautifully written for the five players." Thank you. Samuel Coleridge Taylor would surely have loved Twitter. He was a man in a hurry, and his preferred means of communication in the early 1900s was the telegram. He was a man of regular habits, too. Breakfast at 8:30, composing from 9 a.m. till noon, followed by a long walk before lunch. Before going to bed, he would drink a glass of water, eat an apple, and practice his German grammar. Evidently, he developed a real hankering to go to Berlin and set off several times, but never got farther than Eastbourne. We get these little insights into his routine from the memoir his wife Jessie wrote after his death. She also gives us an account of the romance which was their life together. As you can imagine, a relationship between a white Englishwoman and a coloured man, as he was generally described in the 1890s when he wasn't called a Negro, a man who looked African as Coleridge Taylor did, was not going to be easy. When they announced that they intended to get married, they encountered more or less ubiquitous disapproval. And from Jessie's family, appalled at the idea of mixed marriage, what she described as such bitter resentment that he wasn't even able to visit her at her parents' home. Considerable efforts were made to keep them apart, but they always found ways around them and would spend time together playing pieces like this romantic ballade, Jessie playing the piano and Coleridge Taylor the yearning and melancholy violin part. I've long been looking for an English composer of real genius, and I believe I've found him. That's what August Jaeger, Elgar's editor at the publisher Novello, said when he heard that Ballade in D Minor, originally composed for violin and orchestra in 1895, and subsequently arranged for violin and piano by Samuel Coleridge Taylor. 4 years later, on the penultimate day of December 1899, Jessie and Samuel, who'd been fellow students at the Royal College of Music, got married, not, as would have been traditional, in her parish church, but in his, in Selhurst, near Croydon. She was 30, he was 24. Her parents were, in fact, present, and indeed her father was a witness. The opposition at home seems to have come from her mother. It must have been she who staged managed the horrible scene which took place shortly beforehand, when Coleridge Taylor had gone to ask for Jessie's hand in marriage, and been confronted by her brother-in-law and her father, and told to his face that the wedding couldn't go ahead. According to Coleridge Taylor, he was kicked out of the house by Jessie's brother-in-law. But when it became clear the couple weren't going to be dissuaded, that Coleridge Taylor couldn't be scared off and that Jessie was going to stand up to her parents, the morning before the wedding, her mother told her that she and Jessie's father would like to shake hands with her future husband. As Jessie put it, Samuel's generous heart made this possible. And despite last-ditch attempts to change her mind on the morning itself, and with the aid of a little Dutch carriage her father insisted she should take, the wedding went ahead. On the day, Coleridge Taylor, the composer of Hiawatha, sent her a telegram she always treasured, which read, "You shall enter in my wigwam for the heart's right hand I give you." She said she always regretted not replying with Minnehaha's response, "I will follow you, my husband." To have overcome the obstacles placed in their path and the daily difficulties that must have faced them as a couple in late Victorian and then Edwardian England, their relationship had to be founded on solid rock. Jessie tells us that it was based on mutual respect and on their shared, profound love of music. She was of tremendous practical help to him, working alongside him as an invaluable second pair of eyes in preparing his scores. Nothing got by her. She's obviously referring to August Jaeger when she refers to the German, a great friend and admirer of Coleridge Taylor, she tells us, at an important firm of music publishers, that would be Novello and Co., who, in his hurry, reading the score, had put some notes in the wrong clef. When the proofs were sent back to him, with Jessie's pencilled alterations in the margin, Jaeger responded with this limerick. "There was a young lady called Jessie, perused CT's proofs rather messy, poking fun at old Jaeger, which his knowledge is meagre, this sharp-eyed young lady called Jessie. It would be nice to offer you one of Coleridge Taylor's love songs at this point, but I don't have any. What I do have are these two part songs from the BBC Singers. First, words by the 19th century poet Thomas Hood, tossing us into a Turner-like tempest of sleet, hail and thunder, with raving winds and roiling sea. Specks in the distance, on shore, a woman and child wait and weep and pray for the lone seaman to reach the lee shore. Jessie Coleridge Taylor's memoir doesn't shed a great deal of light on Coleridge Taylor's life beyond the domestic and anecdotes around the concerts he gave and people he met. She doesn't offer us any real insight into his political views, for instance, and how those might have been shaped by his mixed-race ancestry. Growing up, surrounded by his mother's white English family and never having met his African father, Coleridge Taylor doesn't seem to have had any particular awareness of his roots, though his half-sister Marjorie said that he was proud to be a coloured man. But a coloured Englishman, as Jessie confirmed, he always seems to have thought of himself as English. It wasn't until 1896, when the composer was 21, that he had a crucial encounter. That year, the black American poet and novelist Paul Laurence Dunbar visited this country on a six-month reading tour. Dunbar was the son of a former Kentucky slave, and he was the first African American to gain national eminence as a poet and acceptance by both black and white readers. He wrote in standard English, but also in the evocative dialect of the turn-of-the-century black community of the American South. His lyrics of lowly life were so successful that he was invited to lecture and to travel, hence his visit here. It was Dunbar who made Coleridge Taylor not just aware, but proud of his black heritage, and also how he could use his talent in the service of the black cause. The following year, a black bass singer, Henry Loudon, also came to this country, and Coleridge Taylor said that it was Loudon who made him aware of what he called the music of my people. As a result, Coleridge Taylor composed a number of Negro melodies for piano and his African Suite, a four-movement work for piano. Thereafter, he often returned to African themes in his work, in writing music which he perceived to be of African character. In 1900, at 25, he and Loudon took part in the first Pan-African Congress held in Westminster Town Hall, though this was a very small-scale affair. But when performances of Hiawatha began to be given in the USA, Coleridge Taylor began to be a major celebrity. His cause was taken up with evangelical fervour by Henry T. Burley, a black musician who'd studied with Dvorak during his American sojourn, and societies devoted to Coleridge Taylor's music, especially for black singers, sprang up all over the states. When he visited the USA for the first time, Coleridge Taylor was shocked to find how much discrimination black people there faced. In Washington, which was a segregated city, there was the challenge of assembling a decent orchestra. The society there came up with the solution of hiring the band of the U.S. Marines, and Coleridge Taylor became, in what was described at the time as an epoch in the history of the Negro race of the world, the first man with African blood in his veins to conduct the august Marine band. There were further visits on which, for some reason, he began to be referred to by the musicians as the African Marla, and he came to be regarded as a role model for the black community, a shining example of how talent, intelligence, and application could overcome prejudice and disadvantage. He wrote of how it was his hope that all this real striving and earnest work will do something to leaven the prejudice between black and white. Or am I wrong, he asked, and is it a fact that it rather tends to increase it? Thank you. The familiar Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child by Samuel Coleridge Taylor. It was August Jaeger, Elgar's friend at the publisher's Novello, who persuaded his boss to buy the rights to Hiawatha's wedding feast. He agreed, very reluctantly, and in what his wife Jessie described as her husband's unfortunate business transaction, Coleridge Taylor accepted a cheque for the outright purchase of the copyright of the work for just 15 guineas. So, though it went on to be a worldwide hit, he made nothing from it and would struggle financially for the rest of his life. That, at any rate, is how it's represented in most of the accounts. It was in any case clearly a touchy subject, one he seldom mentioned to his wife, though she recalled that on one occasion he'd exclaimed in exasperation, "If only I had a farthing royalty on every copy I sold, I should be a wealthy man." But, according to the traditional accounts, he wasn't rich, and so a life of constant hard work followed. To bring in money, Coleridge Taylor took on conducting engagements everywhere, not just conventional concerts, but Eisteddfods, and all sorts of other competitions as well. He also did a lot of teaching, mainly at Trinity College in London. He took on a teaching post at Crystal Palace School of Art and Music, too, seduced by the office they offered him, which had a panoramic view over London. The principal of the school commented that she never knew a man to be so careless of time or money. Coleridge Taylor was always generous, and Jessie said that whenever he had money, he'd give most of it away to those who were needier than his own family. The couple had two children, and Jessie said her husband would compose while they played next to him on the floor. She also said he'd write a song for ready cash for anyone who'd give him a guinea for it. In the wake of the success of Hiawatha's Wedding Feast, Coleridge Taylor wrote two follow-ups. We'll hear part of the central part of the trilogy, The Death of Minnehaha, which at its premiere apparently had even hard-bitten critics in tears, despite rather than because of the orchestra's dismal performance. We begin with Minnehaha lying, dying in the wigwam with Nokomis. It's been suggested that if he hadn't been taken up by some big classical guns, Samuel Coleridge Taylor might have been a composer of musical theatre. His wife Jessie said he was never happier than when he was writing for the stage. He particularly enjoyed working with that great actor-manager, Sir Herbert Beerbohm Tree. Coleridge Taylor provided music for five of his productions, and according to Jessie, never missed a rehearsal. One Shakespearean project in particular must have been fascinating for Coleridge Taylor as a man of mixed race, Tree's production of Othello in 1911, in which, naturally, he played the title role. Irritatingly, Jessie has not a word to say on this. Coleridge Taylor found himself once, and surely not only on one occasion, barred from going to one of his own concerts by a burly policeman who wanted to know what he thought he was going to do at the concert. It was only on the production of his calling card that the policeman allowed him to go in. Here's a colourful dance from Coleridge Taylor's score for Othello. Thank you. Jessie Coleridge Taylor said she found Beerbohm Tree both alarming and amazing. Her husband admired him as a marvellous producer, but said, "I don't believe Tree knows anything about music, yet he knows exactly what kind of music he wants." Jessie said that while writing for the stage for Coleridge Taylor was a source of infinite joy, it also relieved him from financial embarrassment. Such embarrassment was apparently a constant of their life together, because in spite of his great popularity and the phenomenal success of his Hiawatha music, he'd done a deal which signed away his rights to any income from performances. So he also wrote a great deal for the many choral societies he conducted to make a living. It's often been suggested that the fact that he seems to have worked flat out all the time probably weakened his health and led directly to his early death. Jessie tells us of his working day, in which he'd do 3 hours of composing before lunch, and after rehearsals in London or Croydon in the afternoon, he'd either come home and write more or go on to conduct a concert in the evening. He was clearly constantly on the go. There must have been many a dismal cold winter night when Coleridge Taylor despaired at the prospect of yet more tedious travelling to conduct yet another less than brilliant amateur choir. Here he is, evoking a wild night on the seashore, where a fisherman's daughter stands lit by lightning flashes, staring out to sea. Beyond the reach of the lighthouse beam, the wind whistles through the shrouds of a merchantman. It was chamber music which featured in what was the first ever public concert of Coleridge Taylor's music in Croydon, where he lived in 1893, when he was just 18. His violin sonata had the misfortune to be composed just before Hiawatha's wedding feast, so it was immediately overlooked, and in fact may never have even been performed in the composer's lifetime. But after his death, the famous violinist Albert Sammons somehow got to hear of its existence and included it in his programmes. He also got the sonata published in 1917. After the First World War, it was taken up by the partnership of Winifred Small and Harriet Cohen, and thanks to them, the piece was awarded a Cobbett Prize, set up by one of the men who founded Scandinavia Belting Limited for new works in the chamber music repertoire. This was the only time the Cobbett Prize was awarded posthumously. This violin sonata has all the promise of the young man who was then still a student at the Royal College of Music in London. There were those, probably still are, who found it too popular and lightweight, but as you'll hear from the first movement, it's a thoroughly engaging little piece, full of characteristically fresh and sweet Coleridge Taylor tunes, which have a colourfully folk feel to them, with a tang of the gypsy violin at the start. One of the interesting encounters Coleridge Taylor had on his first tour of the USA in 1904 was with the influential educator and public speaker Booker T. Taliaferro Washington. His approach to the race problem was much less radical and rather more conciliatory than some of the other activists Coleridge Taylor met. Although the composer found him amiable and greatly admired Washington in many ways, he didn't agree with his utilitarian approach to educating black people. Washington, who'd founded the Tuskegee Institute, now university, to train black teachers, was of the view that they need only be taught those things which would be useful to them in finding jobs and making a living, leaving out the artistic and creative side altogether. But he was a powerful figure in the States, and Coleridge Taylor got Booker T. Washington to write a preface to the collection of 24 Negro melodies, which was published in Boston in 1905. Writing in the language of the time, Washington speaks of Coleridge Taylor as the foremost musician of his race, a man in the zenith of his powers, an inspiration to the Negro, since he himself is an embodiment of what are the possibilities of the Negro under favourable development. It is especially gratifying, Booker wrote, that at this time, when the interest in the plantation song seems to be dying out with the generation that gave them birth, when Negro song is in too many minds associated with rag music and more reprehensible coon song, that the most cultivated musician of his race, a man of the highest aesthetic ideals, should seek to give permanence to the folk songs of his people by giving them a new interpretation and an added dignity. According to Washington, the plantation songs known as spirituals are the spontaneous outbursts of intense religious fervour. They breathe a childlike faith in a personal father and glow with the hope that the children of bondage will ultimately pass out of the wilderness of slavery into the land of freedom. The music of these songs goes to the heart because it comes from the heart. The trips Coleridge Taylor made to America were a vital part of the unique journey of his life. Those tours were important in the history of black culture through the rest of the 20th century and shouldn't be forgotten. But the trajectory of his life might have been very different if it hadn't been for the Hiawatha factor. I said at the start that Coleridge Taylor might have had a career in musical theatre, but he might also have followed a more serious line as a composer of chamber music. That's an area where he established a voice of his own at a remarkably early age, and where, for some of his admirers at least, he made perhaps his most distinctive musical contribution. The first concert of his music in Croydon in October 1893 included a performance of his first work in this area, his Piano Quintet, the work he counted as his Opus 1, with its debt to the lyricism of Dvorak, his favourite composer, and maybe just a hint of Schubert. Let's hear the slow second, which begins with a lovely cello solo. I don't know what you thought of the slow movement there. Beautiful, I thought, but passionate as well. Certainly not bad for an 18-year-old. It was of another work written at about the same time, Coleridge Taylor's Nonette, that Sir George Grove, the director of the Royal College of Music, where he was studying by that time, was famously censorious about the slow movement. He'll never write a good slow movement until he's been in love. Well, that at least is one thing which went, ironically, right for Coleridge Taylor. He and Jessie were a devoted couple. I'll end today with another of his songs. Dead in the Sierras has work by Joaquin Miller, oddly enough adopted as a pen name by the fabulous Cincinnatus Heiner Miller, who'd want to drop that. The so-called poet of the Sierras, who'd been in the California gold rush, lived for a year with a tribe of Native Americans, been a Pony Express rider and a horse thief, as well as a lawyer and a judge. He'd seen it all. Coleridge Taylor's setting pictures high up in the mountains, the dead body of a hunter unburied, his campfire grown cold, while the grizzly bear and the panther go about their daily lives, hunting themselves, just as they always did. Samuel Coleridge Taylor was a very big name in his day. Against all the odds, this man of working-class origins and mixed race could fill concert halls in this country and in the USA, and for that matter in Australia, New Zealand, South Africa and India, with audiences eager to hear his music, especially if the work on the posters was his Hiawatha trilogy. But though that was certainly the most popular, Coleridge Taylor wasn't by any means a one-hit wonder. His little concert suite, Petite Suite de Concert, would pack them in too, and in tune with the time when publishing rather than file-sharing was the information superhighway, and playing or singing at home or in groups was the equivalent of the MP3 player, Coleridge Taylor arranged it to suit as many performing options as he could. Here's one of the suite's movements in a version for piano. This has been one of those weeks, and it's often true of composers who die young, where it's quite a job to separate the facts from the mythology. Whatever the reality, one thing does seem incontestable, that he was very happily married to Jessie. She went against the wishes of her parents and all the expectations of the time to marry him, and they seem to have had an enviably contented and harmonious life together. She attended minutely to all the practical details of his life, making sure, for example, that his concert clothes were in perfect condition and just as he wanted them, including a couple of changes of shirt collar in the course of a performance. Jessie was also privy to countless intimate confidences about his music as he was composing it. Just before they were married, as he was writing the characteristic dances, he sent her the four themes, telling her they weren't meant to be ballroom dances, but subjects treated in waltz rhythm as Brahms had done. Thank you. Malcolm Sargent conducted the New Symphony Orchestra in Valse Bohémienne. It tells us quite a lot about Sargent's important role in this story that one of the biographies of the conductor has a chapter headed The Wigwam Years. It was 12 years after Coleridge Taylor's death that a series of staged performances of the Hiawatha Trilogy began, which became a national institution. Hiawatha had an amazing hold on audiences in the 1920s and 30s. By this time, the Western was already established as a major Hollywood staple, so people were familiar with the look which had been invented for the Native Americans by designers of the movies. However inaccurate they may have been, images of the Wild West were widely available in books and magazines. For 2 weeks each summer, between 1924 and the beginning of the Second World War, the annual powwow at the Royal Albert Hall became an indispensable fixture. As the conductor of the only existing recording of Hiawatha, Kenneth Alwyn, has said, the roads to the hall were thronged with 1,000 Red Indian performers, braves and squaws, not from the land of the Dakotas, but from the concrete wigwams of Wapping, Tooting, Penge, Cheam, and Coleridge Taylor's own Croydon. Hiawatha's departure, the final part of the trilogy, was commissioned by the Royal Choral Society. Let's hear from that now, as Hiawatha takes his leave of his people, entrusting to their care their pale-faced guests and bidding them listen to their words of wisdom, since the Master of Life has sent them. Hiawatha then sets off in his birch-bark canoe, westward into the sunset, until he disappears into the purple distance. Coleridge Taylor's skill in writing for voices was much admired in his lifetime. With those sounds still ringing in your ears, you can see why. He wrote 4 operas. I have to say I was rather angry to find I'd missed the world premiere of Thelma earlier this year. And he was always much in demand as a choirmaster. Coleridge Taylor's gentle, persuasive manner seems to have been able to get remarkable results, even from the most unpromising amateur choirs. But he also conducted concerts for the Handel Society for many years. We've had the great pleasure this week of hearing performances of some of Coleridge Taylor's part songs, which are otherwise unavailable, from the BBC singers. Let's hear their final contribution. The Evening Star has words by the Scottish poet Thomas Campbell. There's a statue of him in George Square in Glasgow. It's a Turner-esque image of the star of love rising in the evening sky, while distant herds of cattle are lowing and smoke curls heavenwards from rustic cottages. I mentioned Coleridge Taylor's ability to raise the game of the most average of choirs, which clearly indicates that he had a way with people. He obviously had an exceptionally engaging and vibrant personality. Well, this presumably accounts in part for the relatively few instances of racism that he seems to have encountered. We've also got a sense of how hard-working and dedicated he was. One day, at the end of August 1912, a few days after his 37th birthday, he walked to West Croydon Station, aiming to take a train to Crystal Palace. But he collapsed at the station and somehow managed to struggle home. He was diagnosed with pneumonia. Within a few days, he was dead. The funeral in Croydon on the 5th of September, attended by hundreds of mourners, became a global event, and there were many representatives of the black community there to whom he'd become such an important symbolic figure. Jessie's own account of her husband's final hours tells us that shortly before he died, propped up on pillows in bed, Coleridge Taylor had raised his arms and begun to conduct an imaginary orchestra. The previous day, they'd looked over the orchestral parts of the score of his violin concerto, so the assumption was that that was the music he was hearing in his head moments before he died. It was given its formal British premiere at the Proms in the year he died, 1912, and not heard there again until the 2005 season, which brought it back into the limelight. Listening to the podcast version of Composer of the Week. If you've enjoyed this podcast, you'll find the details of all the music we've played following the links from bbc.co.uk/radio3.